My name is Paula. I'm a compulsive overeater and your leader for this meeting.
I'm Paula.
And I'm operating on the assumption that we start on time, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. As a courtesy to the meeting, please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Thank you. Any other compulsive overeaters here beside myself? Oh, good, because there were other meetings on the property and I wanted to make sure everybody's in the right place. If you came here expecting some other kind of meeting, check the signs out there. May we see the hands of anyone who is new to Overeaters Anonymous and people in their first 30 days of abstinence? Yay! Will you stand and give us your first name?
My name is Levi.
Hi, Levi. Welcome.
I'm Jesse, compulsive overeater.
Hi, Jesse. Anybody else? Great. Anyone from out of town? I live in North Orange County from Fullerton. I'm from Fullerton. I'm from out of town. Yeah, I live in Fullerton. But Lauren is a personal friend of mine, and when she called, we hadn't talked in a while. I said, yes, if you'll have tea with me after. So the purpose of this meeting is to help anyone who thinks they may have an eating problem. Anyone think they have an eating problem? This is a workshop meeting, and we hope that by asking questions, you will better understand our program. May I have a volunteer to read how it works from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Come right up.
Hi, I'm Taylor. I'm a compulsive overeater, sugar addict. Yes. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fall who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living in which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you decide you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find easier, softer way. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to get a hold of our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with food, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has that power, and that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we are powerless over food, that our lives have become unmanageable. 2, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the overeater, the chapter for the agnostics, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were compulsive overeaters and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsive overeating. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
The definition of abstinence in Overeaters Anonymous is the action of refraining from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors while working toward or maintaining a healthy body weight. The definition of recovery in OA is the removal of the need to engage in compulsive eating behaviors. Spiritual, emotional, and physical recovery is the result of living the Overeaters Anonymous 12-step program. May I have a volunteer to explain his or her abstinence?
And there's certain foods I do not eat, and I talk to my sponsor, and I talk to my sponsees, and my sponsor and I read a certain book together. That's it.
Thanks. Okay, it says now is the time for the leader to qualify. I'm Paula. I'm a compulsive overeater. And I am a poster child for slow recovery. Do as little as possible for an acceptable but not excellent result is the motto of my life. So if you can get a B without working, why would you work to get an A? Right? That's, you know, that's sort of the motto of my life. And at the same time, I am a type A driven person. So you can figure out pretty easily how that translates into my OA program. So I'm going to talk about four surrenders that I've made. And each one got me further down the road, and it would have been great if I could have done all those surrenders right up front. And I envy the people who come in. I have one friend who says, you know, it took me a while to get the program. It was 9 months before I really got abstinent, and she's been abstinent and in a normal body weight ever since. It took me longer than 9 years. And I will tell you, a couple of things that saved me were the people who said, you're ready when you're ready. The people who said physical recovery isn't the only kind of recovery. And the one woman who told me, it took me 16 years. So don't worry till you hit year 17. I have a common story. I think I was probably born a compulsive overeater. Not sure. I would sneak cookies. Maybe that's just a kid thing. I would eat the diet candies that my mom had. Maybe that's also a kid thing. Maybe climbing the kitchen counter to reach the children's vitamins is just a kid thing. But I think by the time you're in high school, getting up at midnight to drink Karo syrup straight from the bottle is not a kid thing. So I was pretty hardcore with that. I come from a thin family. My brother and sister, we're all well over 60 now. They are the same size they were when they left high school. They're athletes, and wear the same size clothes as they have all their lives. I don't come from a fat family. We aren't heavy built. I didn't grow up in a house where people overate or were obese as a family condition. It's just me and my disease. So I have no other contingencies to blame it on. I do, however, come from a long line of other kinds of addicts. If you shake my family tree, alcoholics fall out on their heads all over the place. And a couple of rageaholics and control freaks, you know, the usual assortment of things. And after some years in Al-Anon, during which I really turned a corner, I don't think I would have ever found the kind of recovery in OA that I actually have if I hadn't gone to Al-Anon for about 4 or 5, maybe it was 6 years. However, apparently I'm not the kind of person who can manage two programs at a time, because I gained a lot of weight while I was gone from OA and in Al-Anon. I don't consider it a relapse because I continued to think of myself as a compulsive overeater and to think about myself as someone who was working a program. So, you know, if you think you're a compulsive overeater, you're a compulsive overeater, right? Whether you're successfully living the program that's best for you or that you even want to isn't the question, right? It's the question isn't whether or not you're getting an A or a C minus or flunking. It's do you self-identify? And if you self-identify, then this is your place and we have a chair for you. Common story, I started Weight Watchers when I was 16 because I was the family fat girl. And I was actually looking at pictures, perfectly normal, probably near the top of the range. But teenagers, you know, can be, most of us don't weigh what we weighed when we were teenagers, right? I was normal within guidelines on charts. So my dad made me go to the doctor and get a note so that Weight Watchers would take me even though I was, and that they would let me get below their established range for weight. So I would consider, I had a wonderful family, a loving family, but one of those control freaks was my dad. And my brother was already displaying alcoholic behaviors. He started drinking in fifth grade. And I think sometimes people recognize an addiction when it shows up in drugs or alcohol. They don't necessarily recognize food as an addiction. I think that's one of the struggles we still have, right? You can see out there, everybody's got a diet or a program that's going to solve your problem. And for normal people who just need some nutritional guidance or some lifestyle changes, it probably does work. If you're a compulsive overeater, not so much. So my dad went through a season, bless his soul, where he went from controlling to vicious and back again. And that was very traumatic for me. By the time I was 25, I'd seen a therapist. We were past that. And he had long since apologized and come to understand a better way of living. I mean it when I say I had a really wonderful, loving family. Doesn't mean we weren't dysfunctional. Doesn't mean, but I see a lot of families. I get to see inside a lot of families, and I'm lucky. My addiction was born of a need to self-soothe. My family was lavishly loving, but also lavishly critical and lavishly ambitious. And so I certainly always felt that whatever I was doing couldn't possibly be enough. I didn't get straight A's while I was in graduate school, not because I wasn't capable of them, but because, remember what I said at the beginning? If I can get a B without trying, why would I waste my energy trying to get an A? I got some A's because I could get those without trying. But I got a couple of C's, too, which in my family was just tantamount to disaster. Until my brother hit high school and his alcohol interfered with his ability to get decent grades, and then I was off the hook. So my compulsive overeating was compounded by a lot of shame from my family. And, of course, I have, like all American women, and not a few American men as well, I've been traumatized by my culture's expectations for what I should look like. Now that I'm at a normal body weight, I'm still 10 pounds shy of perfect and of an ideal weight. And I can tell you it's because I still nibble on things that are none of my business, right? Mm-hmm. So I should be about 10 pounds less than this. You know, it's just little stuff around here. But I'm pretty sure I missed the window for perfection by about 47 years, right? All those years when I was youthful and had all youthful beauty, I was carrying around anywhere from 40 to 80 extra pounds. So, you know, I'm 6 feet tall. Well, I used to be 6 feet tall, not anymore. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about, right? I'm never going to be a size zero. There is no universe where I'm going to be a size zero. So the addiction became the shame, became the addiction, became the shame, became the addiction, became the shame. I went to OA when I was 19 in the course of making the rounds of all kinds of things. I think I was there for about 4 minutes. I only actually remember one meeting. Maybe I went to several meetings, couldn't tell you. And in those days, meetings were huge. It was easy to hide. There were 100 people in most meetings. I lost a lot of weight after my second child. Pregnancies were a weight loss endeavor for me. Honest to God, my kids were 10 and a half pounds. I gained 6 pounds with each pregnancy. When I was done being pregnant 2 months out, you know, after you lose all the baby weight, I used to say I could have 6 children, I'd be at my ideal weight. The problem is it took me, just about 18 to 24 months to gain all the weight back, you know, between children. So I have some pictures of me after my second child where I lost a lot of weight, went to Jenny Craig for a minute, and I have those pictures. Sometimes people say bring pictures, but I am a tidy soul, and I clean things up, and I have thoroughly cleaned up all my pictures. I probably have 2 pictures of fat me, and it's probably because my kids are in them, and I didn't want to get rid of them. So I came back to OA. Here's my first surrender. I was about 43. I was going through a season of a lot of exercise. I was kickboxing with my daughter as she was getting her black belt. I was having good professional success. Things were going well, and I'd lost some weight, and I thought this is a good time to go back to OA because I had known for years I was a compulsive overeater, probably since I was 19. I had known I was a compulsive overeater. And I thought, this will never stick if I don't do something else. And by then, my brother had been sober in AA for almost 20 years, and I was watching how it had changed his life. I got recovery, mental and emotional recovery. I stopped feeling ashamed. And that was a miracle. And while I was waiting for physical recovery, which took a long time, a really long time, I'll let you know when I get there. I learned to be grateful for the mental and emotional recovery. And many was the time that I said to myself, if this is all I get, okay. If this is all I get, okay. I was very fortunate. My weight did not cause me to have high blood pressure or anything like that. I'm starting to have some trouble with my knees and some arthritis, which, you know, at my age is normal, but probably is aggravated by years and years of that. My second the second thing that happened to me was spiritual recovery. So I am a religious person. I'm a spiritual person. I'm a religious person. I have 2 graduate degrees in religion, and I work in a religious field. And God still was not relieving me of my compulsion. And I would go to OA meetings and people would say, oh, well, surely you have a spiritual life. I would have people come to me because they knew what I did for a living and say, well, obviously you have, you know, the epitome of the spiritual life that I need, I want. I'm like, does it look to you like, you know, my spiritual life in terms of OA is stellar? It was not. And that was very troubling to me. I prayed all the time to be relieved of my compulsion. I prayed all the time to get up in the morning and have the strength to not eat what I knew I didn't need. So I got past that. And it took a long time for me to understand how the spiritual recovery works. And it works very differently for a lot of people. I know people who simply pray in the morning that God will relieve them of their obsession and they're clean all day. That's never what has worked for me. I've needed a different kind of spiritual growth. And I think I got it when it started with the mental and emotional recovery and I stopped feeling ashamed. And then one day, I relapsed for about 4 years, relapsed, maybe not relapsed, while I focused on Al-Anon, and that's okay. It was what I needed. I really needed it. I don't think I would have gotten to Al-Anon if I hadn't been in OA, and I don't think I'd have gotten the recovery eventually in OA if I hadn't spent some time in Al-Anon. That's just my story, and, you know, I that's the life I had, so I don't know what would have happened if something else had happened. And then one day, I was at the doctor, and I got on the scale, and I just want to tell you, do you know that you don't have to get on the scale at the doctor? You don't have to get on the scale at the doctor. If you go to the doctor, you know how they weigh you every time you go in and give you blood? You can say, no thanks, I'll tell you how much I weigh, and they'll go, okay. Because it was too traumatic for me to be on the scale at the doctor. According to my sponsor, I weigh before breakfast with no clothes on. I never go to the doctor before breakfast with no clothes on. So I tell them whatever my last monthly weight was. And even before that, I just said, no. And no one ever insisted. I did try this thing once where I said, I'll turn around and you can weigh me. I don't want to see what I weigh. And she said, okay. And then she says, and right out loud with three people in the hallway, my weight. Like, okay, that didn't work. You know, maybe she graduated at the bottom of the class in nursing school. But what happened when I got on that scale and it said 246, which was my all-time high that I know of, I just had my vision of myself in one of those electric grocery carts. Now, I know people use those electric grocery carts for a lot of different kinds of disabilities, but I also see the people who are 300 and 400 pounds using the grocery cart because walking through a grocery store is too much walking for them. And I thought, if I can be 346, I can be 350. And if I can be, 250. And if I can be 250, I can be 300. Next stop is 300. So I went to a meeting in January of 2006. That's not right. That's not right. Yeah, no, it's 2010. And a guy named Eric welcomed me to that meeting. And the way he is welcoming, he's just one of those guys who's very welcoming, but not, he doesn't attack you. And he's a wisecracker. He's one of these guys who makes sure that our meetings are full of fun. In, I don't know if any of you go to AA meetings. It's none of our business. But boy, those people, those are the party people, right? We're the people who go to the grocery store, close the curtains, and eat alone at home in isolation. So it's really great to have at least a couple of extroverts in your OA life. And Eric was mine. And it was about a month later that I said to someone in that meeting, I know I need to be a no sugar, no white flour person. I had decided when I decided, okay, that's always a problem in this program. I decided without consulting a sponsor, without consulting God, without consulting my experience, that I was going to be a three moderate meals a day gal. And that got me from 225 to 246. And that was part of why it took me so long. My second surrender was in March, on March 28th of 2010. And it was when I decided no sugar, no white flour. I'd given up white flour because a couple years before I was having enough acid reflux that my doctor suggested that I go gluten-free. And that really helped. I also gained some weight. Because, you know, butter is not is gluten-free, popcorn is gluten-free, ice cream is gluten-free, all kind of great stuff. And I mentioned to someone that I just knew in my heart of hearts I was a no sugar, no white flour person. And I just couldn't face it. And she said, there's no shame in not being ready. And as someone who, you know, spends a lot of time being full of shame, that really helped. So that was my second surrender. My first surrender was going back to OA, recognizing that I was clearly not handling this myself. Whoa. And then my second surrender was no sugar, no white flour. Then my third surrender, I had a sponsor who was using Weight Watchers as his food plan. And I'd been in and out of Weight Watchers with less success each time. And he and I both knew that Weight Watchers was not our answer. But he found it to be a very helpful food program because it helped him get an idea of what was enough food for him. Because I was still living like, look, I eat so cleanly, I eat so moderately, why am I still overweight? Now, I don't know, am I the only one who thought that? It's some kind of mental illness where you say, everything I'm eating is fine. Why am I still overweight? And believe me, I've been tested for thyroid as often as I can get a doctor to do it. Right? I knew there was no physiological reason for that, and I still couldn't do the math in my head. You know, I look back now and I think, well, if you're overweight, then what you're eating is not okay. I guess I better hurry. So I lost 65 pounds and I was a normal-ish weight. And that was my third surrender, was surrendering to weighing and measuring and logging my food. And I lost a lot of weight and I was really quite normal and I was happy, except I just knew I was still 10 or 15 pounds shy of the body that I'm supposed to be in. You know, I now my sister's 5'8", and I was just visiting her, and we can swap clothes, right? So I know that I'm in a healthy size body. Well, some little while ago, I guess it's about just 2 years ago, through a series of meetings and a workshop and conversations with a fellow, I began working what is called a sober eating plan. Sober eating is a way, it is OA, but it's a way of eating. And for me, what it mostly meant was the one thing I was never going to do was go back to OA. And then the other thing I was never going to do was stop eating sugar and white flour. And then the third thing I was never going to do was weigh and measure my food, because I was 3 moderate meals a day, right? There I was, you know, way overweight. What this did was separate all my emotions from my eating. I was already doing a lot of that stuff, but what it means is every evening or morning, I send my sponsor my food plan for that day. And if I make a change, I tell her. Now, if I decide to have an apple instead of an orange, I don't tell her. If I have green beans instead of asparagus, I don't tell her. But if it turns out I'm going out to lunch and I'm not going to have what I planned, then I tell her what I am going to do. And, you know, I would never have called myself a particularly emotional eater. I do, you know, but I don't need to eat because of emotions, or I don't need emotions. I guess the way to say that is I don't need to be having emotions in order to eat. All I have to do is be near food and be slightly bored and alone. If I'm alone, then that's the thing I want. And what I realized listening to this sober eating workshop was I was still 3 times a day asking myself this question: what do I feel like eating? And it never occurred to me that that was emotions. You know, I didn't have to be depressed or unhappy or joyful or worried or any of those other emotions that we equate to eating. All I had to do was ask myself, what do I feel like eating? What am I in the mood for? And the last 15 pounds came off. So 4 surrenders. Each one was an occasion where something that used to seem like it was a prison that I was never going to do, something that was going to inhibit my freedom, turned out to be the most freeing thing ever. So I can't tell you how I came to see it that way. I can't tell you what switched that made me see something differently instead of seeing it as a limitation or a task or a job or a chore or a prison. Somehow I woke up one morning and I thought, you know, that could be really freeing. HP, continued attendance at meetings, working the steps, reading the literature, having a sponsor, it all just, you know, coming to OA at all. That's what did it. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it. Okay. Got it. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leaders are their own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking a question, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. Leader, please restate the question. If I forget to restate the question, someone can remind me. Okay? Go ahead.
You mentioned being a religious woman, a spiritual woman. I don't know, I mean, I'm not sure if this is the right way to phrase it, but how did you, in your quest for your sobriety in this program, forgive God for getting you to this space of what felt like?
You know, I didn't need to forgive God.
Repeat your question.
Yes. How did I, thank you. How did I learn to forgive God? I was never angry at God about that. My theology doesn't imply, I don't believe that God is in charge of everything. I actually believe free will is a thing.
Sure.
And so I was pretty sure it was my fault. Forgiving myself mm-hmm. for having a disease I didn't ask for, and then forgiving myself for not coming sooner and not surrendering sooner and all the ways that I resisted the program, that's a different thing. And I learned to forgive myself in this room, these rooms.
How did you learn to forgive yourself?
How did I learn to forgive myself? So I have a pretty strong spiritual practice. I use a practice called centering prayer, which is similar to meditation, but does not expect an instant result. It's just being still and saying to yourself, I'm going to let God work in me in any way God decides to do that. And then the results show up later. So it's a letting. Most of us want to make things happen. And so we have active spirituality. Nothing wrong with that. If you garden for spirituality, if you run for spirituality, if you read, if you study, if you have conversations, those are all great. But there's also passive spirituality where you allow your higher power to do a work in you without telling that higher power how or when or what. And so my spiritual practice for over 20 years now has included that. And I suspect that my acceptance of who I am, that doesn't mean I'm happy about everything about myself. I'm still annoyed by my character traits and sometimes chagrined. But also, once you go through the steps, particularly 8 and 9, and make amends, I've only just within the last year learned how to make amends to myself. And it includes things like don't wait to go to the doctor. Grocery shop. It's not get a pedicure. It's do the things that I didn't do to take care of myself when I was fully in my disease.
Since you mentioned at the start, you are balancing more than one program. And I just wanted you to say more about that.
Well, I didn't. You know, so when I... thank you. How did I balance more than one program? Keep reminding me. I'm obviously not going to remember that. I had a reason, a prompting to get to Al-Anon. And for a while, I went to both kinds of meetings. But I was very caught up in that and needed to be there. So for about a year, I was juggling two programs. But then I just was in Al-Anon for 4 years. And then I found my way back to OA when some of, Al-Anon really took for me. It just really took. Yeah.
Thank you so much for saying that, what you said about what do I feel like eating and what am I in the mood for. It's very, very helpful. It happens to also, please also elaborate if you could a little more. I have the same situation where I feel like I'm, sometimes I have a savory tongue, sometimes a spicy tongue. It's like a crave house. And sometimes I have a crunchy tooth, and other times I feel like this. I feel like there's a storehouse of like cave monsters in my tongue.
Yeah.
That pop out. That pop out and read now and then. So please elaborate on that a little more. You said, if I ask myself, what do I feel like eating, then I do not have to consult with my emotions or something like that.
Well, so the question, I'm trying to repeat the question. It's a little challenging. If I understand, your question is, how do I separate?
One thing is, like, how do you handle this when you just have an impulsive craving to make?
Right. Well, so how do you handle an impulsive craving?
Yeah.
strong.
Yeah, that's what this whole program is about. That's what the whole program is about, start to finish, is to not let those cravings continue. And not everybody needs to do what I needed to do, but I needed to have a sponsor who would, and I would make a plan, usually the night before, and I have to be standing in front of my refrigerator to make the plan. Because otherwise, I come up to lunch, I go, oh, well, I can't have that for lunch because that's about to go rotten, so I need to eat that. Now, I work full time, so sometimes, I take my lunch to work with me and I end up going out or something like that. But that was why I started that. I got to a point where I was listening to a sober eating workshop. You can go to the LA birthday party. There's a recording of the workshop. I can't remember how to find it anymore. And as they talked, I thought, damn, that's what I need. And I connected with a guy who I'd already spoken at two meetings, asked him if he knew a woman who sponsored sober eating. And I just became willing to make a plan ahead of time and follow that plan. And that's because the night before, I usually try to do it the night before, right after I eat dinner. And then I can make a healthy plan. I've had to, make changes in that plan. My initial plan simply wasn't enough food because I have diet head. I think that if I eat three bowls of steam, that by the weekend I'll be back to my birth weight, right? So that's where my head is. So I simply had to surrender to the idea that I was not going to get completely detached from what I was eating. I hear a lot of people use the term food neutrality. And I take that to mean that they are neutral about food. They no longer are controlled by their cravings, whether it's a craving to eat in general or a craving for something in particular. And that's my goal. My goal now is peaceful eating. And I can eat everything on my plan exactly as I planned it and still not be peaceful. But I'm working on peaceful. And separating that from figuring out in the moment what I'm in the mood to eat has sort of been the last brick in the wall for me.
Thank you. Do you sponsor do you have your sponsees do sober eating? And if so, what do you do if they get a little wonky about it?
Okay, do I sponsor sober eating? I do sponsor sober eating. Not all my sponsees are in sober eating. Yeah, that's right. And when they get wonky, I do whatever my sponsor does for me, which is I observe that they got wonky, what's going on. But most of it, my sponsees are pretty experienced. I don't have any beginners right now, and they catch themselves before I catch them. The trouble I have, and I don't know if they have this, because it is that my inclination is to lie to my sponsor. My gut inclination is to lie to my sponsor. So I have to monitor that. She doesn't care if I lie to her. I'm a good liar. She probably doesn't even know. But she's giving me the gift of her time, and I need what she has to give me, and it will only benefit me if I can bring myself to be honest with her. So, yes, Taylor.
Thanks for your share. You spoke a bit at the beginning about the home you grew up in, having a lot of judgment and criticism and perfectionism.
Yeah.
And then you also spoke on a lot of your early work on working on that sort of emotional aspect of things. What was sort of that bridge for you to healing those voices that you're hearing so much from parents or whatever that are
Yeah. So how did I, what happened so that I could be free of being as judgmental of myself as my parents were?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of therapy. I grew up, right? Growing up, you learn your parents are just people. And I became a parent, listened to my parents' voice coming out of my mouth when that wasn't how I wanted my kids to feel. My parents loved their children and had high ambitions for them. And that's why they were critical. is they would probably have considered themselves demanding and encouraging. But, you know, when you're a kid, how things land isn't, well, even when you're an adult, someone may mean something a certain way, but it lands on you differently. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Therapy.
Do you share all this with your kids?
Oh, yeah. Oh, do I share this? Thank you. Do I share this with my kids, my loved ones, my partner? I have a partner. Best thing ever happened to me was my second divorce. You know, we're a program of attraction, not promotion, but if people don't know, then they don't know. So in most situations, I'll tell people I'm part of a 12-step program. If they ask what it is, then I'll say OA. My kids know a lot more than they wish they did. You know, I talk about it all the time. So, but they watched it happen. They watched me go. I started going to OA when they were both still living at home. So, yeah, nothing's a secret. One of the blessings of OA, blessing and curse, is we wear our addiction. I mean, at some point you can't hide your alcoholism or your drug addiction, but you can for a long time. You can't with this, at least the overeating version of it. What else? Somebody timing this? Okay. I'm good. I can talk all day.
You're so good at it.
I'm a professional. Don't try this at home.
You said that you ate to soothe.
Yeah.
With the judgments from your family, did you feel like you ever kind of ate at them?
That's a good question. Did I eat to self-soothe, and did I eat at my family? The very first time I went to a therapist, that was definitely my first takeaway. And I told my parents that the therapist had suggested that maybe I was feeding myself because I wasn't getting fed emotionally. And they listened to that. That's when the criticism started to back off. I was in the middle of college, and I had gone to the dorm where no one was watching and put on a lot of weight, you know. Everybody talks about the freshman 15, and I had a sophomore 50 or something. That's it? Okay, five more minutes.
What did your amends look like to your friends and family?
What did my amends look like to my friends and family? It had relatively little to do with food directly and everything to do with being a bitch. I mean, that's just the short version. Unkind, judgmental, I'm an achiever, and that's great. But I learned a lot about how to make amends to people, not so much from OA as first I learned how to be a good manager of people. Once I was the boss and I had, you know, I don't work in big organizations, but I've always had, you know, 5 to 7 employees. And for a long time I thought their shortcomings were what was preventing our organization from succeeding. Right? Which may have been true in some cases, but my dad was in management, and we talked about this a lot, and I began to understand that my first line of action is to ask myself if I'm managing them well. If they're not performing well as employees, is my management helping them perform better? Am I a good manager? People who are failing as employees, the first place to look is here. Well, that translates readily to other relationships very quickly. If people aren't treating me the way I want to be treated, OA and management, good management, told me, first ask yourself what's going on with you that could change or is getting you those reactions. So my amends had pretty much everything to do with saying unkind things, doing unkind things. My best amends was to my brother because I publicly shamed him once. Well, probably I did it a lot. But we were out and he said something I didn't like politically because we don't agree politically. And he was wrong. His basic fact was wrong. Don't you just love that? And the whole family's having dinner, and I popped off some smart remark that shamed him. And I went on to tell that story for years as evidence of my clever wit putting down his political thing. And then one day I was in the middle of telling that story. I went, oh my God, he's not the asshole. I'm the asshole. And the next time I saw him in person, I apologized. And my brother is one of those people who is deeply sensitive, and a lot of his rigidity comes from not being comfortable with that. He just burst into tears. And in that moment, I swear I saw his face as a five-year-old. I saw him as, he's my younger brother, and we aren't very far apart, any of us, but you know, family constellations being what they were, and me being the bossy, I got the bossy gene. That was the most significant and noteworthy amends, but most of my amends ran along the same lines. And most of my amends were about behaving differently with people. Just behave. I had some people I needed to approach and apologize to. My ex-father-in-law was one of them. But mostly my amends constituted behaving differently.
Do you make a distinction between making amends and apologizing? Is there a difference?
Making amends and apologizing. Is there a difference between making amends and apologizing? Absolutely. Absolutely. If you look in the dictionary, making amends means making things right. Sometimes to make things right, you need to apologize. And we know plenty of people who apologize and make no effort to change anything. Right. I'm really sorry that I took a baseball bat to the windshield of your car. Well, if you don't pay for the new windshield, you haven't really made amends, have you? Being sorry, everybody's sorry. All right.
What do you eat and are you a vegetarian?
I am not a vegetarian. Vegetarian. Repeat the question. Thank you. What do I eat and am I a vegetarian? Time's up. Ask me afterwards. I'll be glad to stick around and tell you I'm not a vegetarian. But I eat a lot of vegetarian type things. And then I just add chicken.